Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Slip Matt, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're all missing that sense of community that the dance floor can bring us, so we at House Culture are absolutely delighted to be able to bring a little bit of the club directly into your world. This is the first time you've tuned into the podcast. First of all, welcome. And second of all, please make sure you get some dusty digital fingertips by digging through our back catalogue of episodes that feature interviews with the likes of Norman Cook, aka Fatboy Slim, Danny Rampling, Mark Archer, Shades of Rhythm, Harry Romero, and many more. Even if there is a name you don't recognise, I guarantee you that they have an interesting story to tell. And if you've only just stumbled across House Culture and want to get to know us a little better, as I always say, we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is where the party happens. You can find us there at houseculturenet. Follow that, and you'll get a daily dose of all things related to this scene we know and love. Let's get on with this next episode, shall we? In this one, we chat to a hardcore hero of mine and a man known to the world as the Godfather of Rave. It's the one and only Slip Matt. In this chat, you'll hear about the DJ that inspired him to get behind the decks for the first time.
I remember going to a club to see Simon Harris doing it live. I can remember standing there by the side of the decks just watching what he was doing, and he was playing all these soul tracks and mixing a cappellas over the top. I was just fascinated by it. Packed club with a really good atmosphere and stuff. I was like, oh man, this is me. Got to be doing this.
The story behind the creation of one of the biggest crossover hardcore anthems of all time.
We knew what type of tune we wanted to do, and there was one, I think it was a Yellow Man Live thing, and he did this a sort of lyric. It's like, right, we've got to find something like that.
You'll also get Slip Matt's view on which era represents the true old school.
I've been playing the old school stuff since day dot, and I've never really stopped. That 90 to 92 era must have just been so powerful, because it's still there. When someone ever talks about, you know, the 90s, it's always around that 2 or 3 years.
And how, after nearly 4 decades in the scene, he remains at the top of his game.
I've gradually started playing more and more new stuff. It's happened naturally, really, playing out, even in the old school sets. So now I'm playing pretty much all new stuff and slipping in a few old bits here and there.
So I hope you're prepared to let this DJ take control. This is Slip Matt.
House Culture.
Right. I'm extremely excited for this, as I'm in Essex, and sat opposite me right now is an absolute legend of the old school scene, the godfather of rave himself. It's Slip Matt. Thanks so much for sitting down with us at House Culture. It's about time we really start to investigate this era and area of the scene. So can you tell us how you first discovered music?
Oh, wow. That goes way, way back, actually, discovering music. I mean, I've been music through and through since before I can remember, because my mum always tells me the story of playing records when I was about 18 months. Basically, we had this old sort of box mono record player with a big lid on it, really old-fashioned ones. And I used to pick up the tunes and put them on. It was like an automatic sort of player, so I used to sort of load up the tunes on top of a long spindle and then sort of flick the automatic button. I used to love playing records, even at that age.
No way.
And I got I was actually given my first record. A neighbour down the road, quite a way down the road, actually had heard, oh yeah, the boy up the road, Matthew, he apparently plays records and he's into music and he's only really young. And he actually gave me a tune. And I actually remember taking that off of him, sitting in a pram, my mum wheeling me up the road. So I must have only been really young. It's a really unusually young sort of memory.
Yeah.
And he gave me this 7-inch record. It's actually an old country dancing record or something. So it wasn't the fact of what was on it.
Yeah.
It was just he wanted to give me a
physical
record.
Thing, yeah.
But I can actually remember sitting in the pram taking it off him. So that must have been one of my earliest ever memories. And that was involving vinyl.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So where was it
you grew up then?
So I grew up in Loughton,
which
was sort of, it's council estate, sort of on the edge of the Debden sort of council estate in Loughton. But it was quite a nice area. Nothing wrong with council estates in general anyway. I like the fact that I grew up in Loughton. It was good, nice area. Bit of both really, bit of everything there, sort of some lots of people from that have moved out of East London, settled there, including my mum and dad. Moved there 2 or 3 years before I was born. And a really nice side to it, really sort of quite a posh side to it as well. So we were sort of lucky to experience sort of all sides of life really there.
And as you got a bit older, you know, obviously you were well into, from that 18 months age, playing around with vinyl and things like that.
I was scratching at 3 and I was doubling out at 4.
So was there a point where you can remember hearing something on the radio and you were like, wow, I really like what I'm hearing?
If it was a particular tune, I bought my first tune when I was 4.
Wow.
Which was 1971.
Yeah. What was that?
Which was Clodagh Rodgers, Jack in a Box or something like that. I think it's Jack in a Box. Again, have a crap tune, but you know, 4 years old, can't judge me on that.
No.
Yeah, I was one of the ones, you know, Sunday night, I'd be there recording the top 40 or top 20, whatever it was back then, on a tape, pulls when the DJ started saying what was what. And I'm trying to think, I was very much into, obviously I had my mum and dad's records there to play, so I used to listen to a lot of the Beatles, used to listen to a bit of Elvis as well, just whatever was around, a lot of 60s music. Obviously, actually, I was born in the 60s, so.
Yeah.
And then I remember getting to about 10 years old, and I can remember being in school and writing I Love Soul Music on my desk, scribing it in. So from about 10 years old, I sort of started getting into the more dancey side of music.
And even having such a taste at understanding your taste in music at that age, that's really still quite young.
Yes. That wasn't just pop music. It wasn't just, you know, what was out there.
Yeah.
It was, I actually had a proper sort of taste in. I suppose being soul music, it was, slightly more niche rather than mainstream, yeah.
Yeah, and that was kind of the dance music of that era as well. And like, if you had your parents' records, you'd have that feeling in your hands of the vinyl, the sleeves, all the notes inside.
Oh. And disco music as well, I suppose. So disco was 77?
Yeah.
76, 77, 78. So at 77 I would have been 10.
Yeah.
Very much into the disco. So I bought my first 12-inch single in, I think it was 77 or 78, Sylvester.
Yeah.
You Make Me Feel, which was one of the biggest disco tracks, but that was on import as well. So even then I was a bit trendy.
So where were you getting imports from at that age?
I went up to Bond Street,
HMV
in Bond Street, back in the day. 10 years old, used to get a red bus rover, go around London
specifically to buy records.
That and cause a bit of trouble. Nothing serious, but no, that and just sort of, you know, run a bit of amok, go and buy 10 fags and jump on the bus and smoke them all before we got home.
And I mean, amongst your peers at school, you were were there other people who were really into their music at that age?
Not in the juniors, really. But then, as the story unfolds, when I got into the senior school, I met Lime, John.
Yeah.
DJ Lime. So yeah. We were in the same class together. I think it was right from the beginning, I think. I think it was right from the first year, if not the second year. But then we naturally sort of gelled together.
Yeah.
His love of music, I think back then it would have been... He was actually into, what would you call it, futuristic stuff like Depeche Mode, Human League, and specifically Depeche Mode.
Yeah.
He used to have a right stupid haircut as well. He used to have a big fringe that stuck out and a bit out the back. I suppose it wasn't stupid at the time. we did used to take the piss out of him. And then he got into the electro sounds.
Yeah.
And then we really sort of gelled, and we used to take tapes into school, play to each other and stuff like that, and eventually got into the whole sort of DJing thing together, yeah.
So in terms of getting into that, the whole DJ thing, as you put it, I try and think, like, during that period, there wasn't much around. If you're too young to get into a club, there's not much on the television in terms of people with decks or mixing or anything like that. How did you understand how this music was being put together, and what inspired you?
It's quite weird, actually, thinking back, because we're so used to having, like, YouTube and social media and stuff now, and this has popped up quite a few times chatting with people. It's like, how the fuck did we know what was going on out there? Do you know what I mean? How did you learn how to DJ? Because there was no school of DJing, and you couldn't just put on YouTube and work out how to do something. But I was actually out clubbing from about 14, probably 14, certainly 14, probably 14, going on 15. I just got my old brother and his mates, who were sort of 17, 18. So that's sort of how we sort of really got into the music, and then sort of watching the DJ and what they were doing.
Yeah.
I can remember one of my first memories of watching the DJ was someone called Simon Harris. He's still about, I think. He used to run a label called Music of Life, hip-hop label.
All right, yeah.
But he was friends with people like Froggy, I think, back in the day, who was very well-known sort of for his... I think he used to do like 10-deck mixing and stuff like that. He was from around our way as well. I remember going to a club called Billie Jean's in Epping and watching Simon Harris. And I can remember standing there by the side of the decks just watching what he was doing. And he was playing all these soul tracks and mixing acapellas over the top. And
right.
I was just fascinated by it.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, wow, this is brilliant. Actually, you know, I was into doing the mixing stuff in different ways. I used to have reel-to-reels at home, and I used to get up to all sorts of different creations and experiments. But to see Simon Harris doing it live at a club, packed club, you know, with a really good atmosphere and stuff, I was like, oh man, this is me. I've got to be doing this.
So at that point, had you already got decks as well, or was that the inspiration?
I think Lime had decks before me. He had a set of, I think they were Garrards, just, you know, one of these coffin things.
Yeah.
And we both used to go on that, and we'd mix, we'd try and scratch, but the needle didn't really sort of grip too good. But we just mix just by pushing the tracks around with a finger, find a couple of tracks that are fairly close on BPM.
Yeah.
And either slow one down or speed one up. Probably sounded terrible if you listen back now. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I think just experimenting in that way is just the way you kind of learn these things, isn't it? You just like mess around and see what happens.
Yeah, and it sort of come naturally to both of us, really, just because we were so into it. It wasn't something that we thought, oh, you know, we've got to learn how to do that.
Yeah.
He was like, we're going to learn how to do it, whatever. It's sort of come naturally, yeah.
So were you thinking about, okay, I've seen this DJ rock a club. Obviously, you're inspired by the technicality aspect of it.
Mm.
Was there also having a crowd a kind of side effect of that, or was it like, I want to be a performer as well?
No, I wasn't really the performer side, if I'm honest. It was the technical side and just the sort of wanting to do it. I don't know, you know, maybe there was an underlying thing that I wanted people to listen.
Yeah.
But it certainly wasn't, I want to be in front of loads of people sort of showing off sort of thing.
Yeah.
Definitely not that. I'm trying to think back. I think I must have been about 17 or 18 when I got my first decks.
What were they?
They were Citronic.
Yeah.
Citronic deck. I actually designed this coffin case from place called High Tech in Dalston, East London. And I was trying to work out, I had to get decks with pitch control, and these Citronics fitted my price range.
Yeah.
But I needed to get that and a decent mix, so I chose an MRT 60 Phonic. Mm-hmm. With two of these decks, and I was like, "All right, yeah, we can do that, and we can get something made to size." So I got that done, and then they ended up getting loads and loads of them done, and sold them for a good couple of years, I think.
Wow.
Yeah, so I should have been a designer. So, well, I was a designer; they just didn't pay me for it. Should have got a freebie. Yeah, so I got that and a set of big heavy set of speakers. I can't remember what they were, and a big amplifier.
Mm.
And I remember my mum and dad moved up to Dunmo when I was 18, and I remember taking all the kit up there with me, and I think I played over the road in the pub a couple of times.
Yeah.
With my decks and speakers and stuff. The mobile DJ thing never really took off. Lyme was out doing a couple of bars around Loughton and Buckhurst.
And were you thinking about producing any tracks at this time or anything like that, or just was it just messing around?
Yeah, it was really. I've never really thought of. Recently, I've sort of realised that the whole production thing was the seed was planted for that.
Yeah,
sort of a long time before. Yeah, so we made our first track in 1989.
Yeah,
in fact, so that was pretty early in the whole rave scene. And we were doing stuff before that. Me and Lyme, we used to go up to Ritzy in Tottenham, and we'd met up with these two blokes that used to rap, Gino and Mikey. They were called. I'd love to see them now. Actually, if they're still about. And they came round a couple of times, and we had a Roland 505 drum machine. Can't remember what else we used to use. I think that was probably about it, really. And then we used to sort of scratch a few bits over the top with some records, yeah. And then we recorded them rapping over the top of it. So that must have been probably 86, 87, I think.
Yeah.
Very, very scrappy sort of demos, but, you know, we shown a massive interest. Yeah, there was one particular point. I was around at Lyme's. He'd just got home from work, and he'd bought Marshall Jefferson Movie Body. And he's like, "Matt, listen to this." And we was like, "Wow." I can remember that moment thinking, there's something different about this track. It feels like a different type of music.
Yeah.
Maybe to other people it didn't, I don't know, but there was something in there, that actual foundation of what, you know, became real sort of proper house music, that it just stuck out like a sore thumb to me. And it was like, "Oh, right, this is different. Yeah, this is great."
Yeah.
And from that point, we were hooked. I was still into my hip-hop stuff right the way through to early 90s. But yeah, from 86, and then I think the first tune I bought was Jackie Body on import as well.
Of course.
It's a bit like saying when people say, "Oh, yeah, no, I've got that on vinyl on social media."
Yeah.
So I've got to say, "Well, yeah, I had it on import."
Yeah, I've got it on the original label.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty amazing, really. And that was pretty much pre-rave as well. Mm-hmm. So that was the start of house music.
Yeah.
But then 87, I bought Land of Confusion, Armando. Yeah. And that, we sampled that for our first SL2 track in 1989.
Yeah.
So Acid House for me started just about in 87, as far as I can think of it, and then rave sort of started to explode in 88.
Yeah, so I mean, the whole rave scene, obviously you've been part of that scene since the beginning.
Mm.
Were you going to events before you were DJing at them, or did they kind of happen concurrently?
Yeah, it's weird. I wasn't really. I don't see myself as an actual raver.
Yeah.
I was never really that actual raver, going out there and proper having it and getting off my tits and stuff. But I was a clubber. We were going to see what happened in the late 80s. The club nights then sort of turned into raves. Tottenham Ritzy went from sort of all mirrors everywhere to then closed down, I think, for a while because it just couldn't attract the people anymore. And then sort of turned into a rave. But I think probably places like Camden Palace. So there was a transition, actually, from going to the sort of shiny clubs, like we used to go to 06, was it Bananas up in the West End, and then Tottenham Ritzy on a regular, Elton's in Tottenham as well. And I seem to remember it went from doing that to then going to places like the Wag. It was like the whole sort of Rare Groove sort of days, that transition into Rare Groove, and music started getting a bit more of a UK scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then club-wise, probably, I remember going up with all my mates, all my sort of more ravey sort of mates, going up to Camden Palace, places like that, and then Astoria.
Did you think, okay, I'm kind of set up here, I'm in prime position, I've got the tracks, I've got the equipment and the talent?
There was no plan, though, that's the thing. Did it just absolutely happen? No plan at all. And it was so different back in the late 80s.
Yeah.
I mean, DJing wasn't really, you know, DJs were people that worked in clubs,
yeah,
or radio sort of thing. You know, there wasn't this DJ culture as far as I remember. So yeah, there was no plan at all. It was just purely out of the need. We needed to fulfil our wishes, try and DJ and mix. It's more about mixing than DJing, yeah. I think, really, and make music. So we made our first track, as I said, in 1989. I remember taking it up to Camden Palace and getting asking Chris Paul to play it.
Did he play
which
it?
He did.
How was
which
that?
Which he actually did, yeah. Oh, brilliant. We actually played a tune on tape, actually, on cassette up at Ritzy in Tottenham. God knows how we managed to persuade him to do that. I would never do that for someone. No. Sod that. Maybe it's half empty. Maybe the club was half empty at the time. I don't know. Maybe it was an early one. But yeah, there was no plan.
Mm.
No plan at all. I had never thought that I would be sitting here all these years, you know, 30 odd years later.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With a 30-year career under my belt as a DJ.
Yeah,
amazing.
That's incredible.
Mm.
And can you remember, if you cast your mind back, what was the gig where you thought, I've made it now, or this is now my career? Where was that turning point? Where were you playing? And were you always Slipmat from the start?
I was Matt Nelson at first.
Yeah.
Matt Nelson. I found an old business card a little while ago. I think it was Matt Nelson, the best in soul music, something like that. So really, so me and my friends started off our pirate station, which was Roar FM. A couple of my mates were working for, I think it was Tower Hamlets Council, doing sort of engineering work and stuff. So they were doing all metal work and locksmith stuff and all that. And they knew where all the squats were around East London. It's quite handy, really, if you're thinking about starting a pirate station. So we ended up at a place called Devil Point in Hackney Wick. Mm-hmm. They broke in. Put a new locks on the door. This was on the 18th floor. Long story short, 18th floor. We lasted a few weeks in there. We had the aerial sticking out the balcony, so you could see it from everywhere. And we got done by the DTI. I actually lost my decks there as well. I still had the Citronic ones. I had a set of Technics at home.
Yeah.
But I donated the Citronic ones to the station just to get started. And they went, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Which was gutting. And then, in fact, then I did a swap. I did a deal with my mates to give them my Technics 1200 silver ones. And I went and bought a set of 1210s myself, a new set. Yeah. That must have been 89. So then we moved up. So we basically just moved up to the top floor.
Yeah.
And then totally sealed it up. No one could have got in there at all. And these were like professional sort of engineers as well.
Yeah.
So we had cables going up. The soil pipe, believe it or not, which is pretty disgusting.
Who run those cables?
My mate Graham, actually, he was one of my DJ mates. I'm still not around with him now, but he said it was horrible. We sort of looked over, it's like, whoa! Had to get this cable through. Once it was done, it was done, and we never actually got anything taken away after that. I think we had a dummy rig, so we had power cables going up. The lift shaft into the top of the lift, which was quite tricky to get into, and then we had we tried making a rig and it never worked, so it looked like one,
yeah,
but it just had the power for it. So if they managed to get up there and take that off, the power would go off,
yeah,
and the actual main rig was up right up on the roof. You needed like a couple of ladders to get up there and stuff,
yeah.
So we never lost anything after that. So
how long was that running for?
I reckon probably best part of a year, I think.
Yeah,
we must have started it summer 89. Because Braindance started in September 89,
yeah,
and we were running adverts for that. As my brother, we'll get into that. Yeah. But it was my brother that started Braindance,
yeah.
And then we went for quite a while, but it was just a hobby. It wasn't a business or anything. There were six of us, and we used to go out there at the weekends, play a load of music, smoke a load of puff, just have a laugh, have a laugh up there. Really, there's no toilet. You used to have to piss in the bath, and it was proper. proper messy old times and stuff. It was good.
Yeah,
that was really, really, really good fun. And we just used to go out the weekends. We had a double auto reverse cassette player, and she used to put a couple of tapes in there, and that used to run pretty much all week. If someone was passing, they'd pop me in and change the tapes over.
No way.
And it's quite handy actually, because you quite handy, but at the same time a little bit nerve-wracking, because if it went off you'd be like, shit, what's going on?
Yeah.
But if it was still running, you'd be thinking, yeah, brilliant. Good. So yeah, stressful. So we did that, and then Raindance took off. Raindance was my, I always look at Raindance as my first proper rave gig. I'd done a couple of club gigs before that, but that was the first proper rave, so September 89. And then from that, I then started getting a lot busier as a DJ. So I can remember then doing the radio and having to go off on a Saturday night rather than staying there and getting stoned. Go off on a Saturday night and go up to Leicester or to Colchester or wherever. Yeah. So from, sort of end of 89 through 1990, I started getting a lot busier.
Yeah.
I was an apprentice electrician at the time. Mm-hmm. So that just shows you. I mean, I must have taken that on in the summer of 89, that apprenticeship. That just shows I had no plans to be a DJ.
Yeah. And during that period, you're travelling around and playing in these different places.
Yeah.
Did you feel like something was happening, that this was the beginning of a movement, or was it just like, I'm just doing this for fun?
It was fun. It was, do you know what? I was an apprentice for 2 years. First year, I was earning £40 a week, and it was just, that was a nightmare. So a couple of DJ gigs was really, really helpful. Yeah. I was even doing a bit of cab driving, actually. Must have been, 21, 22. My brother was a cabbie, and very lucky for me, very nice of him, actually. But he put me on his insurance. Yeah. I don't know if he could even do that these days. I think you need a proper licence and everything now. But so I used to do a couple of nights cabbing to try and make my money up. But the DJing was handy. Yeah, it was just fun. It was just so new and different. Yeah. 1989, it wasn't even legal.
Yeah.
So there was no real thought of it being a long-term business or anything. So then going through 1990, must have been playing at places like Telepathy, mm-hmm. stuff like that in East London, and I gradually started getting more and more work outside of London as we went into 1991, and the whole rave scene was getting much, much bigger.
Yeah,
it had become legal, and there's a lot of legal club nights on. So we were still making records. SL2 brought out The Noise and Bassquake.
Yeah,
I think beginning of 91. Which actually went really well. We just did it on our own label.
Yeah.
We got burnt on the first one, actually, on the first track in 89. We never got paid for it, which is no biggie.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. The Noise come out on our own label, which was Awesome Records.
Yeah.
And then we followed up with DJs Take Control.
Yeah.
And Wham a Brain.
Yeah.
Summer of 91.
Yeah.
And then my apprenticeship come to an end, June 91, and then we got the record signed.
Yeah, amazing.
This is exactly the same time. In fact, John had gone over to Ibiza with a load of my mates from the radio station. I think they went over there for about a month, just because it was all going off over there. It was all necking pills and getting off the tits. And he left me with his phone because we were getting calls from record companies. So I had the Motorola brick with me for my last probably month as an electrician, which was pretty cool. And then we were getting calls from, I think we had about 8 different labels onto us to sign up DJs Take Control. We went with XL Recordings, and that was it. I left my apprenticeship, didn't carry on doing that. From that point, then it was like, right, okay, I think this is it.
And obviously XL, home of, at that time, Prodigy, Liquid, and all those kind of big tunes from back then.
Yeah, and it was good. You know, we had Walk Records. There was a lot of different labels that wanted us. So it was, we knew we were onto something good. I suppose at the time, if I look back, my thought would have been, oh, right, okay, I'll take a break from being a Sparky. I can always go back to that. Yeah. I finished off my apprenticeship, but it just never happened.
Thank God. I mean, DJs Take Control of that track specifically. Obviously, it samples Knight Riders, Let the Music Use You. What was your relationship with that track before you sampled it? Was it something you'd heard and be like, that's a great riff, I want to use that? Or was it just something you grabbed in the studio
No. So we actually had a plan with that. So my DJ career wasn't planned from the start, but I do actually like planning. From playing at Rain Dance and a few other places, we could see what we needed to do.
Hmm.
We had a really, really sort of strong vision back in the day of what we wanted, really sort of firm ideas. And basically, we was like, right, okay, we need a really fucking heavy beat, heavy break beat, kick drum as well. We need to go into the gooeyest sort of, uplifting sort of breakdown that we possibly can. We obviously went through our tracks, but that was, pre-planned before we actually went in the studio. We had all the parts there, so the beat was dirty as anything. In fact... When after XL signed it, we went to do the radio edit, and they asked us to change the breakbeat because it was too crackly.
No way.
That's ridiculous these days. Yeah. People add crackle now, don't they, to their tracks. But where it was crackly, yeah, there's like, oh, look, you know, it's a bit too raw and sort of dirty. So luckily, well, in fact, the break beat for Wham of Brain was the same beat, but a clean version of it, really clean version of it. So we just swapped it over. So if you ever get a chance to compare, listen to the 7-inch version.
Oh, right, okay.
And the 12-inch version.
Yeah.
And you'll notice the difference.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. I'll check that out, definitely.
Yeah. So we put them together and then played it at, I don't know what it would have been, maybe the Egg or Rain Dance, the Egg or one of them ones, sort of middle of 91.
Yeah.
First play on a white label, it sort of worked and was like, yep, sounds nice and loud. It's working. And then it got round to the next Rain Dance, which was probably about a month after.
Yeah.
And it just exploded. It was just like, wow.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah. And had you...
And then, you know, from playing it after that, then the phone started ringing.
Yeah. And at that point, had you been sharing it around to other people, or were you the only people that had copies of it?
Yeah, we were working with Moe's Music Machine.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave Moe's 250 white labels, just got white labels done to start with. And they went out within about an hour. It was like ridiculous. It was like, get some more, quick, got to get some more of this tune. So we did I think we did 500 on a actual labelled copies, and we give them 250 of them, and they just shot out again. And it was like, right, hold on a minute. I mean, the phone was ringing and everything. We thought, no, we can't keep putting these promos out. And I think XL actually bought the rest of them off us. I think, yeah.
Isn't there, I think there's some knocking around that are like on the original Awesome label, but have the XL sticker on.
That's right, yeah. So that would have been it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, amazing times.
Yeah. And from DJs Take Control, obviously the next track was On a Ragged Tip. Samples Walk and Skank.
Yeah.
Where did that come
from? So we didn't really talk about my other sort of love of music. I've always been into reggae.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say always. From about 12, probably about 12 years old, I was listening to Rodigan on Capital Radio. Every Saturday, cassette player. And she just used to record it every week. And I was absolutely mental on reggae. It was a big influence on my sort of production, and probably a big influence on why I wanted to get involved in making music as well, because the reggae thing was so sort of raw.
Yeah.
And all that. One of the things I used to love about it was all the jingles, all the Rodigan jingles and that. It's just amazing. So Wayne Brain, of course.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Was sort of off the back. Yeah, John was into the reggae thing as well. The reggae thing came from my side.
Yeah.
But so the Wayne Brain, and that really worked, you know, that was pretty much a double A side for us, really.
Yeah.
You know, there's people that preferred Wayne Brain to DJs. So Ragga Tip was meant to be the flip side of I think it's Changing Tracks.
Yeah.
I should know really, shouldn't I? Ragga Tip is so much bigger. So that was actually the follow-up. So we thought, yeah, it'd be nice to follow up because Wayne Brain was so big and we loved the reggae stuff as well. And same with that, we actually hunted that down. So we knew what type of tune we wanted to do. So I was listening to a lot of Yellow Man and stuff like that at the time. And there was one, I think it was a Yellow Man live thing, and he did this sort of lyric as a sort of bit of an intro. I said to John, right, we've got to find something like that. I think we probably tried something Yellow Man, but it didn't work. And I actually went round to another mate of mine, actually, Shaquille, Indian friend of mine, dead now, actually, God bless his soul. But he had this Walk and Skank track there, and we found it. It was like, that's it. It works.
Yeah.
Absolutely worked. So, yeah, that's how that came about, really. So, same again, it was an idea that we knew exactly what we wanted, and we found pretty much exactly what we had in our heads.
Yeah,
wasn't far off at all. Yeah. And then so that was the flip side. Took it to XL, they liked the whole EP. And then actually me and John, I think John said it first, he was like, oh, the Ragga Tip track, it's just like, there's something about it, it's just, do you think we should put it as the A side, as the main track? And I was like, yeah, I think actually maybe you're right. And then we went to Nick Hawks XL, and he sort of did his usual And totally agreed. And so it became the A-side, yeah.
It's an indelible track from that era obviously it did really well in the charts. Did it get to number one in one chart? There were obviously two charts, two top 40s at that
point. Yeah, yeah. So in fact, DJs Take Control, we didn't even mention that. That got to number 11 in the chart.
Yeah.
DJs Take Control, and we got on top of the pops with that. So back in 91, that was the other big thing. We were suddenly from electrician to, like, you know, a couple of months after, being top of the pops.
That's crazy.
Interviews all over the country on radio and dance energy. Mm-hmm. Norm Ski up in Manchester and stuff. So it got to number one for, I think it was a day on a midweek, which isn't official. But I'm so glad I know that he was actually number one for a day or two days. I think it might have been a day. And we were actually over in LA doing a gig. I remember we were sitting in a hotel room. I think John was on the phone. So I think it was probably Nick Hawks, because the track had come out, and obviously we were due a midweek. So hard to remember. I should actually research it and then remember it, really. I think we went in at 10 or 8 or something. This was the second week, and we was like, wow, you know, we've gone straight in top 10. That's mental.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, you're number one. He said, you're midweek. This was on the Wednesday. He said, you're number one. I was like, what? I thought, wow.
Yeah.
Absolute. Yeah, in less than a year.
Well, it's like you say, it's good that you know that as well. It's not often that you'd... You know, you'd get the midweek position.
Yeah, and then I think it was the next day, we'd gone down to two.
Mm.
And it was KWS, Please Don't Go.
Oh, was it?
That's an annoying tune in the world.
Sorry. You'll never forget that one.
And that was a huge tune as well. So it was really unlucky for us, because I think that stayed at number one for weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
So it was bad timing for us, really.
Well, if you're on the dance floor now and someone puts on KWS, the dance floor probably would clear, wouldn't it? SL2.
I hope so.
And everyone's going to run onto it.
Yeah, you're right. You're probably right, I don't think people would remember the Please Don't Go track. But we was number one on the network chart, which was your Capital Radio and I suppose the commercial stations around the country.
Yeah.
So we got number one there, and obviously number one in the dance chart and stuff.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
I suppose after that, you know, the scene, the journey through the scene musically, like 92 and then like 93 and 94 kind of era was where it started to kind of really diverge and split. Mm. Obviously you had the more like jungle drum and bass kind of sound coming in, like more breakbeaty, then a more kick drum kind of hardcore sound. You kind of fell into the latter. During that point where the scene was going in different directions, was it like a conscious decision, or was it just like, I like what I play and I'm just going to go play this? Or did you realise that the scene was splitting?
Bit of both, really. We were sort of riding the sails of things. You know what I mean, it was sort of going with the flow in a way. Throughout 92, the music just sped up.
Yeah.
It went from, you know, beginning of 92, we were, BPM-wise, we were sort of between 130 and 140. And by December, it was 150 to 160, basically.
It's nuts.
Yeah, it had just changed. It's weird. Those first few years of the rave thing so much going on and so much change compared to the last 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot smaller, I suppose, now. The actual rave side of things is a lot smaller. So by the end of 92, we released Whammer Brain, the remix, in, I think it was, it's either November or December. It might have actually been beginning of December, I think. And that went into, it made the, I think it got to about 31, something like 32. I'm not saying it should have got any higher, but I think that was pretty much a reflection on rave music in the charts and you know, commercially at that time. And then from that point, it just totally, sort of the slope just went, just sort of totally dropped off.
So commercially...
So commercially, after Whammer Brain, you know, the label was sort of saying, oh, you know, what are you going to do? And we just didn't want to... I was like super busy DJing, like mad busy all over the world, or certainly all over the UK at that point. And we just didn't want to go down that commercial route. And it's not that we didn't want to, we didn't probably didn't really know how to.
Yeah.
We weren't proper musicians. You know, we were a couple of DJs that had made a couple of sort of successful tunes and done quite a few sort of good underground tunes. And that was it with the commercial stuff for a long time. That was us done with XL, really.
Yeah.
We probably could have said, oh, right, okay, look, let's get some producers in or whatever and see if we can keep the SL2 name going and all that. But we just weren't really interested. John certainly wasn't interested in anything aiming for commercial. I think it's probably a good move. I don't think that was us. So then going into 93, the whole music then started changing with, I suppose, as the commercial side of things sort of dropped off, probably the raves... changed a lot. You know, people got into more, you know, into different stuff. I think people were probably getting back into house music again as well. I mean, same was still big, but it had changed. So it had gone very, very dark, very fast, very breakbeat, very dark. Jungle was sort of becoming a lot bigger, and I personally saw a bit of a gap for the more sort of happier style of stuff. You know, stuff we were playing for sort of throughout 92, like Edge One, Terrorize, Just a Feeling, all those sort of real sort of uplifting tracks. I did like the dark stuff, and I played it for a good couple of years after the jungle. You know, I even made a bit of jungle music and stuff, and was well into that. I was part of the creation of that, I suppose, really, to an extent as well. But I saw that sort of gap, and then decided to get my own sample. We was using John's equipment, the studio equipment at the time. Thought, well, right now I've got to do something about this. So I went and got myself an S1000 and an Atari, and then made the SMD series.
Yeah, that's often credited as like the first hardcore kind of track that kicked it all off. There you go. Yeah. Introduced like the kick drum.
I invented jungle.
There you go.
I invented that the hardcore. That's a joke, by the way.
And just, you know, take us through kind of building that and the samples that you used.
My inspiration for that was Edge One. Edge One was a track all the way through 92, or from when it was made in 92. That was a track that you could put out on, bang. Like, you know, pretty much 90% of all dance floors would go mental. Very often last tune of the set and stuff like that, last tune of the night. So I wanted to sort of recreate something along that vibe, and it turned out to be SMD1. The riff in SMD1 is it's a totally different sound, but the way I've done it is quite similar to the big riff in Edge 1. I wanted a nice heavy kick and stuff, hi-hats and that. So yeah, that's what come out of SMD1, come out, was inspired by Edge 1, sort of to recreate that vibe in 93. Pianos from an old white label, Congress, which charted, actually. I don't know if they changed the name of it.
40 miles.
They put the vocal on top, didn't they? So I took the original white label, that was a huge tune for me throughout 91. So I nicked the piano off of that, which they were fine with that. I don't know if I spoke to them at the time, but I've spoken to them since, and that's fine. This wasn't their piano anyway. And then made that really, really big. I sort of split it so when the piano come in, it just went all over the place. Managed to get a really, really loud pressing, and it just took off. SMD1 took off. Sort of the start of happy hardcore, really. Along with There was myself, people like Ramos and Supreme, mm-hmm. and we sort of ended up a bit of a sort of small community of of DJs that sort of grew,
there. Mm. I mean, were you surprised at that point of how, looking back, are you surprised how influential that was?
My vision, I had the vision for the track to do what it, and it worked. It did exactly what I wanted it to do. But then as the months went on, the scene divided more and more into dark side and jungle and hardcore.
Well, I mean, during that period, you could definitely tell, like, for me, as we spoke before the mics came on, my brother was well into the hardcore scene. I got decks when I was super young. What taught me how to mix was, you know, I had a few hardcore records that I remember my brother getting the Dreamscape 6 tape pack. It's got your tape in it. And I realised that in your set you played two tracks together that I had in my box at home. Oh, and I was like, oh, wow, okay, I can, like... And that's mixing those two together was, like, it was Sunset Regime, Sunshine, and SMD2.
Yeah. And two big tracks from 93 from that sort of happy hardcore movement sort of thing,
In a way, like, as soon as one bit ends in one track, the next bit on the new one had come in, and I was like, okay... Suddenly, the light bulb moment, you've really thought about placing those two elements together. Yeah. Mm. And then that was, for me, that was kind of what taught me how to mix. Like, understanding when one drops out, you start, the other bit comes in. And even to this day, that's kind of how I mix. So, yeah,
that's
thanks
quite
for that.
Interesting. that's actually really good. I'm glad you said that as well.
Yeah.
So all the way through to 91, 92, I do a lot of practice with my DJ before I go out. And a lot of the mixes would be... worked out like that.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't do a whole hour of, I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but I knew what tunes would go with what.
Yeah, and what drops out
I'd bring tracks in, you wouldn't hear it, I wouldn't actually bring it in, but I knew exactly where I was going to bring it in, and then it would, very much so, yeah. That's interesting, yeah. And then, you know, and then that was 93, so 93 was a big year for that happy hardcore thing, and the four beat, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
But even then, by 94, I made a couple of big crossover jungle tracks as well. So Breaking Free and Hear Me.
Yeah.
And I'm still doing that type of stuff, sort of quite heavy breakbeat sort of music. I mean, Breaking Free, I think Bookham took a dub of that. Mickey Finn took a dub. Possibly Randall. There was quite a few of the sort of more jungle DJs that were sort of well into that as well.
Yeah. Obviously, you say you used to know your records, really super practice, and you said about quality control and listening to stuff back. There's a whole real community now of, like, tape packs going online, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, all this stuff. Have you listened back to any of your sets from, like, you know, these are some are 30 years old, so to speak, and are you impressed with it, or is it just part of your
history? Do you know what? I'm actually quietly quite chuffed that I did all that practice back in the day, because some of the tape packs are terrible. But luckily, I mean, there's loads of mistakes in mine, tons of them. But it's probably good that I did do a lot of practice, because it's not as bad as it could have been.
Some others are.
Yeah. No, I've remastered a lot of the old tape packs and stuff. Really? I mean, there's so many out there, I could never find them all. But I've actually released a USB a couple of years ago with loads of the old tape packs on. I'm just about to release another one in the next couple of months, part two, which will have probably a couple hundred different sets.
Oh, incredible.
On there, all remastered.
Yeah.
I'll get a chance to cut out the odd bit here and there as well.
Overdub some bits.
Yeah. Cut that bit out. Nah, I don't do too much of that, but you know, records jump and stuff like that can get a bit annoying, or the MC's a bit too loud. But yeah, no, I always listen to the listening back. I still do that now with my podcasts. Mm-hmm. Always listen back just in case there's a mistake, or if something got exported with a gap in it or something like that. It's always good to listen to your progress as well.
Yeah, and in your productions, it was always a stamp of quality, certainly when I was buying records during that time. A Slipmat remix was, like, always better than the original. It was even now, when me and my brother are talking about music, like current stuff, and there'll be a remix of something new, and they've done a really good job with it and made it better than the original. Like, the shorthand between me and my brother is, oh, it's like a Slipmat remix. You know, it's like, he's done a Slipmat remix on this. It's like, yeah.
Oh, wicked. Thank you.
No worries. Cool. I mean, we've kind of circled around Ibiza as well. You set up the kind of Slip Back in Time events over there.
Mm.
Just tell us about those and what the inspiration was for that.
The Ibiza thing started in 1994. first year I went out. I got booked to play at Chaos, which is now Eden. And that was more of a hardcore thing, I think, hardcore drum and bass. And I played there the next, I think, 95. I think we went out with United Dance in 95. So that was more of a happy hardcore thing.
Yeah.
But we had great fun. That was absolute madness, yeah. 95 or 96. And then I'm sure it was 96. I started playing for 1830s. They did a thing at Benamusa Park, which is known as a zoo.
Yeah.
Called Sundance. I remember at one point, it was about 3,500 people in there. And I was playing. They was booking me to play old school, but I was playing old school and house. My brother had started the Aquarium in London.
Yep.
That was his club. He started that in 95. And that was all house. So I used to play there sometimes as well.
Yeah.
So from... It's weird with the house thing. I started house in 86 and played house right the way through, really. And then, sort of, you know, 91, 92, 93, I got sort of sidetracked into, not sidetracked, but my focus was on the, you know, the hardcore stuff and the jungle stuff and it. But then by 95, I was back playing house again as a regular thing on top of everything else. Yeah, so from 96, I was playing Ibiza regularly. I've been there every single year. I've worked out, I've been there over 200 times over the years. It's a bit like a home from home. I've got friends there that I just go and any time, at any point in the year, I can go over and stay for as long as I want stuff.
Where's the best place for you to play over there? Where do you enjoy the most?
At the moment, I like Eden, actually.
Mm-hmm.
At the moment. It's just so good what they've done with the club. Sound system's amazing. Just everything about it. One of my best mates over there is a manager as well.
Yeah.
Which is nice, Dermot.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got a huge, huge history with Ibiza, backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've played a lot of the clubs. We used to play Space now and again, and, you know, some of the big places, the S Paradise, loads and loads.
Yeah.
Had residencies at Nightlife, which is at the bottom of the West End.
Mm-hmm.
Which West End makes it sound a bit cheesy, but it's a real... that was just absolutely amazing. That's where we sort of say that Slip Back in Time was born from 2000.
Yeah.
In there, really, because I was doing every week, and we sort of called it Slip Back in Time from there. It wasn't officially Slip Back in Time, but that is... It's where it come from. It was official in my head. It wasn't official on the on the flyer, but we then sort of took the brand from there.
And was that, you know, the rave scene? You kind of said that you kind of picked up the house baton back again in kind of the late to mid 90s. Was there a point where, in terms of like the rave scene, where you thought, actually, this has had its time now and I'm going to go this way?
There was actually, yeah, there was. So... not with the original sort of old school tracks.
Yeah,
I'll always play them, and you know, even now, still, you know, it still works. Dropping Zero B Lockout, even though it's been so overplayed, but you know, tracks like that at the right point, you still play it. But so I was playing the happy hardcore thing was huge for me right the way through the 90s.
Yeah,
especially up to sort of 97, 98, and I was traveling all over the world. Backwards and forwards to Australia and even America and stuff. But by 99, the hardcore thing was just getting really, really boring for me. Really stale, the happy hardcore side of things. And I can actually remember back thinking, you know, I hadn't bought any new tunes for about a year.
Yeah.
Or not bought or you know, played anything new. It had just gone really, really stale, really boring. And at that point, I think it had for everyone. At that point, then you had DJs like Dougal and Fools and Styles were making new, slightly different, newer stuff. I think it was off the back of the trance era. And so the hardcore breakdowns were turning into sort of real trancey, sort of sped up trancey sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And that wasn't really me. I suppose I was more into the house sort of thing. I was playing a lot of trance as well, especially through the summer, all around the Med, like Ibiza, Mallorca, stuff with the 1830s and that. So I sort of... pretty much ditched that happy hardcore thing at the end of the 90s.
Yeah.
Still do the occasional set. It's great fun. Still love it. You know, I still love some of the tunes, even though some people might think they're cheesy, but it's just good fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good fun, yeah. Can't knock it. If you've got a good crowd in front of you as well as a DJ playing some of that stuff, and if they're really enjoying it, you can't not smile.
Now, to this day, I can't, no matter what style of music it is, if it's got some massive piano breakdown in it, I'm all over it.
Yeah, and if everyone's jumping around, smiling, and having fun, so it's great. It's absolutely great.
And I suppose circling back to Ibiza and Slip Back in Time, and the kind of just generally the re-emergence of the old school in a way. I mean, it's quite funny in that the old school has always been a part of this scene, in like, but it's the old school kind of never really moves years, really. It's like a certain era.
It makes you think. It was so powerful.
Mm.
That 90 to 92 mm-hmm. era must have just been so powerful, because it's still there. When someone ever talks about, you know, the 90s, it's always around that, those yeah. couple of years, 2 or 3 years. So I've been playing the old school stuff since day dot, and I've never really stopped with that era. And in fact, all the times that I've been to Ibiza over the years, although I've been playing house, I'd always drop a couple of old school tunes in.
Yeah. And in terms of that old school sound, a lot of your sets, there's a real mixture between the originals yeah. and, you know, newer stuff. And where do you draw the line? Is it important to obviously honour the old school but innovate at the same time? But we have done an interview with Mark Archer from Alternate. He was very much like, I only want to play the originals, and that's I'll play. Yeah.
No,
and
I'm totally different to that. Yeah. I'm very different to Mark anyway.
Yeah.
I love
yeah.
Mark's a bit, actually.
Yeah.
He comes over and plays for us as well.
Yeah.
So I've known Mark since day dot. We've had some mad ones together in Ibiza as well over the years. Oh, some really funny stories. So the next part of my yeah. story leading up to now, really, is as a DJ, I went totally digital, went CDs, and then went to controller,
mm-hmm.
actually. And then by doing that, I then, from using a laptop with a controller, I managed to get a lot more music together, old stuff. Sort of dig into the vaults and rip loads more vinyl and stuff. So I went from 2010 up until a few years ago, I was ripping loads of old school tracks. And there was so many people say, oh, there's an old school revival going on with it. There's always been one. Every year there's one. It's like every yeah. day there's one, really. But people just notice it in their own way. But there was a bit, for me, there was a bit from 2010, 2011. I just dug a lot deeper, and I think a few of us did, and revived a lot more of the old school stuff, a lot more of the real underground stuff. So it wasn't just the same old On a Ragga Tip, Awesome Free Don't Go, you yeah. know, which gets very tedious after a while. So I went through that phase, and then on my 50th birthday, I'd started playing a bit more new house. I was thinking, oh, I can't keep doing this. I've got to play something new. On my 50th birthday, I started my Slips House podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I'll do it on my 50th birthday, because then it can be the birthday of the podcast and the show and everything. Good time to do it. So from that point, I've really started playing new stuff yeah. on a regular basis, which was what I wanted to do, and it's just changed everything for me again. So what's happened is, over the past few years, I've gradually started playing more and more new stuff, getting more and more into new stuff, and it's happened naturally, really. Playing out, I'm like, oh, I'm not going to play that. I'm going to play a new track. So
why not?
Even in the old school sets, I've started playing a lot of newer mixes
yeah.
of the old tracks,
yeah.
and then slipping in some proper sort of new bits as well. And it's been actually surprised over the last couple of years of how people have reacted positively
mm-hmm.
towards it. Some of the old school people can be really sort of negative, that whole vinyl thing. Oh,
yeah.
I'm not playing vinyl, you know, all that old rubbish. And very sort of stuck in their ways.
Yeah.
But actually playing out, it's had quite a positive reaction overall. So now I'm playing pretty much all new stuff.
Yeah.
And slipping in a few old bits here and there.
What I always found with the rave scene was I'd find a track that had sampled something, and I'd go back and find out where that sample came from.
Yeah.
If you're playing updates of older stuff now, people can dig back into those vaults and discover the original. So
yeah, 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 yeah. So, yeah, some of the newer mixes are a bit shit or whatever.
Yeah.
For me, there's some really good sort of new mixes, and it's just taken me now into playing a lot more new stuff. So since lockdown, I've been doing my show every week. I was doing like a monthly show on Centrefalls, and now doing that every week.
Yeah,
that's going down really well. It's getting tons and tons of replays on Mixcloud, and the podcast is going really well. It's all got sort of going from strength to strength. We spoke about it earlier. I've been playing for Clockwork for the last couple of years, and that seems to be going well. By middle of March this year, I had around 100 gigs booked up for the year, just for 2020.
Yeah,
and that's like 10 weeks into the year.
Yeah,
two gigs a week. Yeah. So my year was sorted. Yeah. And then, I don't know, but you know, there's tons of stuff coming in. So
yeah.
And that's pretty much all sort of house orientated stuff. Yeah, it's working.
Good.
Yeah, it's working for me, and absolutely loving the music.
Yeah.
You know, I've sat there recently and thought this is actually like going back to 86, 87 and those early days, thinking, oh, this, you know, this music. It's a bit like that for me, which is really, really nice.
In terms
really
of what, nice. Passion and inspiration?
Yeah, just really feeling it.
Yeah.
Just really feeling it. Now, some of these producers must be like, you know, half my age. And they're really, really getting into it. It's funny, but I listened to a conversation with Tall Paul the other day, and it's interesting what he said about some of the old music being fast.
Yeah.
And I picked up one out. I was like, yeah, and I thought exactly the same thing. And it's sort of a bit problematic in a way, because some of the stuff from, you know, some of the old trance tracks and that, they're like 140 BPM.
Yeah.
Just doesn't sound right anymore.
No, and like I love listening to sets from all eras, but that almost mid to late 90s, like Paul, I think we're talking about Rock the House with Tall Paul.
Yeah.
Like, you put that on and it's really fast and it sounds...
It sounds like a hard house now.
Yeah. Or you listen to a trance set and you're kind of like, this... I love all the tracks, but it just sounds like it's all pitched up too far.
I was trying to find some trance tracks the other day just to do a bit on the radio, and it was too fast. I was like, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll just try slowing them down, I suppose. But I don't know, yeah, there's that, certainly that era. Yeah, late 90s house.
Yeah.
Where it got up to about 140 and it's like...
Yeah. It's kind of technically not house. It's weird. So you've been part of this scene from the beginning. Obviously, we've kind of mentioned digital and ripping vinyl and things like that. What has changed the most over that period and what has stayed the same? Is it... In my mind, it would be the technology's changed and just the crowds and people have, in terms of vibe, has remained the same. What are your thoughts?
Spot on, actually. Yeah. I think spot on, yeah. Technology's certainly changed.
Do you prefer playing digitally now?
Yeah, I do, yeah. I've always tried to not be sort of too upfront with everything, but I've embraced the changes as they've come along. So when CDJs were sort of easy, when you could find them in most clubs... I changed over to CDJ because then I could rip all my tunes and then chop them up and edit them, remaster them. So there was always certain vinyls that you couldn't play them at every venue, because most venues you'd go into in the 90s, the levels were full up.
Yeah,
everything was whacked up to maximum. And if you had a bit of a low vinyl, if it's really low, it just wouldn't work in some places. So so I could remaster everything and all that. So and then with the controller, I then put cue points on all my tracks.
Yep.
And I could flick around the tunes and do all sorts of different stuff. I use Rekordbox now, just with USB, but same with that. I grid everything. I use cue points. Every track I get goes into the computer. It gets mastered if it needs to, which doesn't really these days.
Yeah.
Everything's tagged, mixed in key, cue points, gridded, Bosch. Everything's all nice and tidy. And I love it. Absolutely love the new technology.
I've read that you've got a book coming out. Is this right, or is this on the back burner?
Yeah, well, it shouldn't be. You know what, I do notes for what I've got to do every week, and it's on my notes every week. And I do little tiny bits here and there. I've been trying to write this book for about 6 years now. And I've got lots of stuff, lots of notes of it. I've started bits. I've sort of almost got the first chapter done.
Yeah.
It's just getting around to doing it. And I thought, oh, right, with this lockdown thing, okay, not going to be going out much. I'll get this book done and get some music done.
Yeah.
Got one track done in 4 months. And that's with someone else.
Yeah.
And I've probably done about 2,000 words on the book. It's like,
I mean, I think this whole lockdown thing, but at the beginning of lockdown, everyone was like, oh, yeah, I could, like, learn a skill, I could learn a new language, you're gonna have all this free time. Actually, it's not turned out like that at all. Just had
been busier, but just not earned a penny. So I've embraced the online stuff. I'd never actually done a Facebook Live DJ set, and it really wasn't my thing. I don't see the benefit in watching the DJ. Maybe that's because I'm a DJ myself, I don't know. I'm not really a showman in that way, but that was the only way to do it. And people were saying, oh, look, you know, come on, we want you to DJ, and that's the only way you can do it. So I embraced that, and I decided to then just do as much as I can.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, life isn't all about money, certainly not at all. It's about, for me, it's about giving a service to people and making people smile and dance and whatever. The money's just, it's just what happens. It's just, you know, if you do a good job, get more money.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. So I just try and do a good job, and if the money comes, then great.
Yeah.
There's a bit more to it than that, but basically, it's not about the money at all. So it's about keeping out there in front of people.
Yeah.
And putting smiles on people's faces. It's been so nice, all the messages coming back saying, oh, you know, you've been there for us over the last few months. I don't know what we would have done without you. I mean, it's probably a bit over the top, but...
No, it's been great. I've been, you know, no one can go out. So, you know, it's been fantastic, you know, yourself and loads of other DJs have been doing it. And it's been great. You know, sometimes Friday nights, Saturday nights, you just have the pick of the best to choose from,
yeah.
You know. Not long may it continue in terms of lockdown, but in terms of, do you think this is a new way of DJs working with technology once lockdown ends, or do you just see it as like, actually these guys have got free time to do it, when the lockdown finishes we're going to be back out there on the circuit?
Yeah, I think it's probably opened up something new for people. I mean, even now, so the figures, the first one I did was for Moondance, and it went up. I remember looking at the Facebook page and it went up to like 7,000. It's like, bloody hell. Do you know what I mean? That's 7,000 devices.
Yeah.
So there could be like 15,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
I wouldn't normally go out on a Friday night and play to 15,000 people. That's like a once in a year sort of gig, you know.
Yeah.
So it's certainly opened something up, but the figures have come down as you know, as people have got used to it. But yeah, I think the whole online thing, I think it will stay around, but... you know, I can't wait to get back out there gigging.
Yeah. Do you see
it's not going to take over. I think a few people sort of commented and sort of said, oh, you know, maybe the gigs ain't going to happen anymore. It'll just all be online. No, that's not going
to
happen.
Yeah, people are itching to get back in a club.
Yeah, totally. When it's safe as well.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, we'll talk about the playlist. Unless you've got anything else you want to get in there.
With the whole DJing thing and the technology stuff and that, I've got my website, I've started my DJ Hub, which we're bringing together a community of DJs and just giving something back. I've teamed up with a friend of mine, Terry Hooligan from Atomic Hooligan. He's got his own academy called On The Rise, which he's had for ages and ages. He's an amazing tutor. I've teamed up with him to sort of pull in people. So we've been doing webinars together and stuff. So I'm sort of giving my knowledge. He's giving his. We've got Mark Ecstasy as well, Mark XTC from Manchester. He works at Manchester College, teaching music and DJing stuff as well. So there's the three of us. We're doing like weekly webinar as well as some podcasts and stuff as well. Not so much this sort of podcast, more on sort of technology and DJing and sort of more how-to stuff, you know. Education, but that's quite interesting. Nice to give something back.
Yeah,
there, you know, I've built up. I'm not necessarily a teacher myself, but I've built up 30 years of sort of experience and stuff. It's so nice to give a bit back, and the community seem to be loving it at the moment. Yeah,
good.
Yeah,
really good. Cool. Giving back. That's always good.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's try and talk about the playlist then. Obviously, we always ask our guests 5 tracks, 5 themes. We've got a massive, this playlist on Spotify is huge now, obviously everyone's submitted like 5 tracks, so at least 5 tracks, and it's pretty big, even to the point now I'm having to say, someone else has chosen that one, do you want to change that up? All yours were all 100%
really?
Fine, that's great. The Night Riders, Let The Music Use You, has been chosen by a few people before, and I did think maybe you were going to choose that because of DJs Take Control, but no, in terms of Catalyst, we kind of already talked about it, the first track that kind of got you into house music. Have you got any kind of personal experiences, first time you heard it, or memories of that tune specifically?
It was just another tune that stuck out. There was Jack Your Body and at the same time Move Your Body, Marshall Jefferson.
Yeah.
But Jack Your Body, I'm sure that got to number one, actually.
I think it did,
in 87. Yeah. I got it on import in 86, so it's a bit out front there.
Love it.
Got that on vinyl. Yeah, it was just, you know, it was a standout track. It's just very different from what had been around beforehand. But the energy in it as well. I still love playing it now, and I still play that mix that I gave you. I thought it was a dub mix. It's come up as a club mix. I reckon they've changed that round.
Okay.
But yeah, it's full of energy, and it's still, I don't play it loads, but when I do, it normally works. To whatever crowd, whether it's I'm playing new house or old school, just one of them tunes, just energy.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
And we kind of talked about floor filler as well, edge one compounded.
Yeah, so
compounded,
I mean, from when that came out, it's just like every time, absolutely every time I used to play it right the way through 92 and beyond, it just works. It's just an amazing track. It's not really a commercial sounding track. If there was anything commercial about it, it probably would have got to number one, I think.
Yeah.
But for years and years and years, it's just one of them tracks that everyone would go mental to, and they still do.
A Sunsetter you've chosen.
Yeah, I'm not big on the sunset thing. I do like the chill out stuff. Got myself a couple of chill out CDs over the years and stuff. But Adagio, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
I do love that. I love the Ferry Colston mix and the Tiesto mix as well, actually.
Yeah.
Both just miss each other. There's tons of good chill, not tons, but there's a few good ones, but I think I could sit and clear the old cobwebs out of mind for that one.
And a tearjerker, go on, you pronounce that.
So it's a bit of a different choice, really. Yeah. So that's actually a brand new tune. So
yeah,
that's Moreno Pezzolato and Kevin McKay, yeah, Touch Me. So it's brand new house tune.
Yeah.
But they've used an old vocal.
Is it 49ers, Touch Me? Oh, who I'm sure sampled it from somewhere else.
It's a very well-known old folk. I can't think what it's actually from. But it's not a tearjerker, but there's something in what they've done with it. And like I say, it's brand new.
Yeah.
It actually touches me inside. It does something. They've just got something really, really right in there. Really good, yeah. And it's sort of one of the tunes that at the moment has just made me love the whole house thing.
Yeah.
It's got a bit of an old school feel to it as well.
Yeah, I listened to it just before I came down and was like, it's got some piano in it as well. Yeah, I was like, this is good, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. Great track. So, yeah, it's not, you know, tearjerkers are on a different sort of genre, sort of things like... On a totally different types of music, favourite tracks, things like Imagine, John Lennon.
Mm-hmm.
Was it Wonderful World?
Yeah. Is it
Louis Armstrong?
Louis Armstrong, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of real sort of oldies that are, the, you know, emotional tracks.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've had all
lyrics,
sorts. Yeah.
Lyrics and stuff, yeah. Louis Armstrong, and then Imagine is one of my favourites, the lyrics and everything.
And a last tune, crowd are asking for one more. Of course you play this.
Oh, what did I choose for that one? It's got to be the most played last tune for me, I think.
Yeah.
But on a ragged tip, yeah.
And still, he's still proud, surprised when you see that rock in a dance floor.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. Yeah, surprised. I when we made it, I would never have thought it would be as big and as popular as it is. Especially this length of time after. We've actually got a new remix, so we licensed it to Virgin Media.
Yeah.
Part of the deal was they actually remixed it for us as well. So they said, we want to license your tune, but we're going to remix it for the ad to fit the advert.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. And we were sort of quite, not nervous, but quite sort of, you know, oh, what's this mix going to be like? Are we going to like it? Because it's our tune. Obviously, we don't want it shit mix going all over the telly. I don't think we'll turn the money down, but I think the mix is wicked.
Yeah.
We were absolutely blown away.
Yeah.
Absolutely blown away with it. Really, really good. So I've been playing the remix out now.
Awesome.
As well. Last tune as well.
Done.
Not every set, but if the crowd's sort of slightly ravey. If the crowd's a bit ravey, they expect me to play it anyway. Yeah. So it's always nice to do that.
Cool. And the final question we always ask is, we're House Culture, you've been a part of the scene, the culture of this whole movement since the beginning. What are your feelings on it as a whole, and what it's brought you in your life and your career when you look back on it as a whole?
It brings everyone together, I think. House music, you know, the slogans, it's a spiritual thing, it's a, you know, and all that sort of stuff. It really, really is. I think even more so now. Yeah, it just brings people together, and I think we need that more than ever. At the moment, with people dividing up into groups, I really, really don't like that.
Yeah.
Let house music bring us all together again as one. We don't need to be different. We don't need to be labelled as different or anything at all.
And everyone's the same under one roof, aren't they, when they're all on the dance floor?
Yeah. Why should we segregate us as different types of people? We're not. We're all one, and especially with house music.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Let's end there. It's brilliant. Nice one. Thank you so much. That's great. Cool.
House Culture.
Thank you, Slipmat. What a humble guy, right? I want to personally thank him for taking the time out of his schedule for the interview and for inviting me into his home studio to record it. I also apologise for me geeking out and fanboying him a couple of times in that interview, but as you heard, the guy basically taught me how to mix with me studying his tapes from a young age, so it's a real honour to meet one of my actual real-life heroes. In terms of the stuff we chatted about, the second edition of Remastered Sets he mentioned will be coming out on a USB at some point in early December, so keep an eye out for that. Also, don't forget to tune in to his amazing Slips House podcast, which you can listen to on Mixcloud, SoundCloud, or wherever else you get your podcasts. And if you want to add some more sick beats to those recommendations, you can find all of the tracks that Slipmat picked for our perfect playlist on Spotify. These were Steve Silk Hurley's Jack Your Body for The Catalyst, the anthem that is Edge One's Compounded for his Floor Filler, the beautiful Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber for his Sunsetter, the tearjerker was the Lorenzo Spano and the Rituals remix of Touch Me by Moreno Pazzolato and Kevin McKay, and his last tune was, of course, his own On a Ragga Tip by SL2. Just open up your player, search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and you'll be presented with a plethora of tunes that feature sounds from every corner of this thing we call house, all chosen by our podcast guests, past and present. Once you've followed the Perfect Playlist on Spotify, please support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, by leaving us a rating or a review on Apple. This is really important and will help us continue to create these episodes that we hope you love listening to. And it could also get you a shout out on a future one as well. This time, the lucky shout goes out to Michael Hooker, who told me via Instagram that, being from the UK but currently based in the US, this podcast is a great way to highlight to people how much house music culture is ingrained into the UK culture. Well, thanks for the kind words, Michael, and hopefully some of our upcoming guests will help you to continue to spread the word amongst your US pals. But I can't say any more than that at the moment. Other than that, we have some huge guests that are going to round out this second season at the end of the year. Watch this space. And if you want to be like Mike and get in touch, you can do that by hitting up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. This way you'll be kept connected to other house music lovers from across the world. And finally, if you want to reach out to me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.